Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Biden's Soviet forces were steadily advancing. It seemed only a matter of time before they would be on German soil. The survival of Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party and its celebrated thousand-year Third Reich was in serious jeopardy. In a final, desperate strategy to bolster his beleaguered conventional forces, German SS Commander Heinrich Himmler ordered the formation of a guerrilla fighting force. Its purpose was to assist the army by infiltrating behind Western Allied and Soviet front lines. Then, like human U-boats, they would attack supply lines, fuel depots, and other targets of opportunity.
What they would do is they would slow the enemy advance up. And as they slowed the enemy advance up, this would give Germany time to pursue other kinds of options. Germany would have some time to negotiate with the Allies. Germany would have time to develop its wonder weapons. They might not actually win the war anymore, but they might come out with a relatively even settlement at the end of the war.
Himmler assigned command of this new secret force to SS General Hans Preutzmann. His background, fighting Soviet partisans along Germany's Eastern Front, made him the perfect candidate.
Preutzmann was a pretty brutal character. He'd actually been SS police commander in Ukraine and South Russia. On top of that, during their German retreat from Russia, the Germans had tried to set up some settler colonies made up of ethnic Germans who were supposed to defend the frontier against the Russians. He had played a role in that. One of those settlements, incidentally, was called Werewolf, codenamed Werewolf.
Werewolf was also the code name Preutzmann gave to his new command of Nazi guerrillas. For Germans living in the 1940s, the name Werewolf had a powerful resonance.
The werewolf is a mythological beast from the Middle Ages who would come at night into people's homes to kill them. In addition to that, Adolf Hitler favored the word wolf. His dog was named Wolf. The wolf was a magic word to him, and the werewolf was a symbol from earlier times that would serve to haunt the enemies.
To keep the werewolf organization functioning during any communications disruption with Berlin, Preutzmann decentralized command in favor of more independent, regionally controlled groups. Across Germany, local Nazi and police units attracted recruits with promises of an exciting new mission, SS rank, and an increased salary. It's estimated that up to 5,000 werewolves eventually enlisted. They consisted largely of discharged older soldiers, non-essential industrial workers, and especially Hitler Youth.
There was an assumption in 1945 that Hitler Youth were the true Nazis, that they'd grown up under the Third Reich. They were fully imbued with the ideology, that they would fight fanatically.
Erich Lost was 18 years old and a captain in the Hitler Youth. In 1945, he enthusiastically joined the Nazi guerrilla werewolves. Today, he is one of the few surviving members.
They were telling us there was this wonder weapon, and they were not quite done with it, but we had to wait a while for it. I believe this.
In an unusual policy for the times, the werewolves also accepted women. They accounted for up to 15% of the recruits. Because of this secretive nature, werewolf groups often trained in remote locations, such as at this large fortress in the Rhineland. Training consisted of a shortened version given to the typical infantrymen, including orienteering, marching, and riflery.
We had what infantrymen had for that time. We had a machine gun, a Panzerfaust, and we also had mines, so we could blow things up.
Recruits received extensive lessons in espionage and sabotage methods.
They would show werewolves how to use this by blowing up tree stumps and things like that, and by giving them hands-on training in how to use these explosives. And then these troops were expected to use these explosives in much more aggressive fashion once they'd been deployed behind Allied lines.
During this part of the training, many werewolves became disenchanted. Fighting behind enemy lines while wearing civilian clothes was illegal under the international rules of military engagement. If they were caught, they could be shot. But for true believers in the Nazi cause, nothing would stand in their way. As the Allies were about to find out in the first German city they would occupy. When the Allies pushed into Germany beginning in the fall of 1944, the Nazi guerrilla resistance force launched desperate, unconventional attacks. Werewolf teams of up to six people infiltrated behind enemy lines by traveling through forests at night. They often buried themselves in pre-built bunkers, allowing enemy troops to bypass their position. When the coast was clear, they would emerge to conduct ambushes.
It was planned that the Americans would come over our way, and we would not be detected. And then we would be able to stop them by killing them, creating confusion, cutting off their supplies, shooting them in the cover of night.
Sniping, wire cutting, and small explosives caused the most havoc. Another effective tactic involved the use of landmines.
The Allies would oftentimes not check the roads that they were already rolling along because they'd already been checked for mines. So if someone came out from the woods and put a mine under a road, then that could prove to be a real problem for the Allies. A vehicle could run over it and have an explosion.
Werewolves were also given orders to kill anyone collaborating with the Allies. It's believed they murdered scores, if not hundreds of civilians by the war's end. One of their most successful operations occurred in Aachen, a city located along Germany's western border with Holland and Belgium. The American forces captured Aachen on October 21, 1944. It would be the first German city to be occupied. The Americans immediately recruited non-Nazis to form a new local administration and to restart essential services to the city's remaining residents. This new German provisional government became a symbolic success for the Allies and a major embarrassment to the Nazi leaders in Berlin.
It was devastating for them. The German government called the new regime of Aachen traitors. And Joseph Goebbels said upon their return, they will hang the traitors on every tree in Aachen.
Heinrich Himmler ordered his werewolf guerrillas to assassinate the new mayor. He intended this to be a clear message to any other potential collaborators. In March 1945, 2 months before Germany surrendered, a five-man, one-woman team parachuted behind the Allied lines into Belgium. They then crossed overland towards Aachen, killing a border guard in the process. Late the next evening, they finally arrived here, at the home of Aachen's new mayor, Franz Oppenhoff.
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. The clip you heard there was about the Nazi werewolf resistance. There does seem to be little resistance after May 1945 that I can tell. It seems to have suited the Allies to play up the amount of resistance in order to justify their severe treatment of the defeated Germans. So I'm not going to be talking about the Allies who believed that there was going to be a bastion holding out in Bavaria, which never happened, but the Allies did seem to believe that was going to be the case. There may well have been some small pockets fighting in the Bavarian forests. I don't know, but what we're going to be talking about is the group called the Werewolves, set up by Himmler in November 1944. So as the Allies took territory in the west, the resistance was set up to fight behind enemy lines. In a speech in November 1944, Himmler said, "In the territory too, where they believe they have conquered us, new resistance will spring up behind their backs time and time again. And like werewolves, brave as death, volunteers will strike the enemy." The speech was made in Aachen, North Rhine-Westphalia, which is just inside Germany's border with the border of Holland. Himmler had been personally offended by the fall of Aachen, also known as Bad Aachen. He had been in the city just before the siege had begun and had promised his audience of party leaders that Aachen would never be evacuated. Though he was a man rarely given to anger, the whole sorry role played by the local party bosses in the siege had infuriated him. Schmier, the Kreisleiter of Aachen, was dismissed from his party office, flung out of the party itself, and sent to the front as a common soldier, primarily because of the way he had bungled the evacuation of the civilian population. Now, Himmler's assistants were reporting to him that several thousand civilians who had remained in Aachen had welcomed the Americans as if they were liberators, and that the enemy press was full of their anti-Nazi statements to eager reporters, interviewing their first German civilians. In a letter to the SS police chief of the West, General Karl Gutenberger, he wrote angrily, "From the enemy press, it is clear that in some areas occupied by the Anglo-Americans, the local population is behaving in a manner without honour. I order that immediately these areas have been recaptured, the guilty parties should be brought to justice. Now we should attempt to educate the population in question by the execution of the death penalty behind the front." The task of carrying out such executions was given to the Werewolf organisation, formed in November 1944, as Unterhermen Werewolf, Enterprise Werewolf. When the Red Army captured Ukraine, Prutzmann, who had been sent by Hitler to Russia as one of the party representatives, returned to the Reich, where he was given a post on Himmler's staff. There he gained the reputation of being idle and vain, running his office so inefficiently that Schellenberg, a fellow SS general, remonstrated with Himmler to close it down. I should just say, I'm using for this podcast a book by Charles Whiting, which is called Werewolf, the Nazi Resistance Movement, 1944-1945. So if there is any errors in this, then blame Charles Whiting. Schellenberg's remonstrances had some effect, for Himmler decided that, rather than give command of the Werewolf organisation to Prutzmann, he would put in charge a man whom the Americans were soon to dub the most wanted man in Europe, SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny. Skorzeny was already a legend in Germany. After joining the Liebenstaat, Hitler's bodyguard, in 1944, as a private, he had quickly risen through the ranks until in 1941 he had been wounded and returned to Berlin, past fit only for limited duty. But he was not the kind of man to be tied to a desk job for long, and by the end of that year he found himself in charge of the new secret German commando force, which had been inspired by the success of the British operation. So that's kind of a separate thing, Skorzeny's attempts of using sort of captured American jeeps and that kind of stuff. We're not actually talking about that, but this is just letting you know what Skorzeny was up to at the time. In late November, Hitler summoned Skorzeny to his new headquarters near the village of Hohenschen. The Reichsführer introduced Skorzeny to the other men present, Schellenberg, Kaltenbrunner, and Prutzmann. Then he got down to business. He explained that the purpose of the discussion was to ensure that the new Werewolf was properly organised. Up to now, it had been left to individual Gauleiters and SS police chiefs to set up the new resistance movement, each in their own individual way. But according to Himmler, their efforts were not good enough. Prutzmann looked down at his papers as Himmler said to Skorzeny, "I think that this would really be your kind of work, or do you have enough on your plate already?" Skorzeny thought quickly. During the course of the German retreat eastwards, after the Allied invasion of Normandy, he had built up a network of agents in France and Belgium. but so far had had little success with his organisation. So the author thinks, Herr Reichsführer, he said, I feel I have enough to do already. Himmler thought for a moment, then turning to Prutzmann, he said to the others, may I introduce to you the new head and organiser of the Werewolf? Prutzmann did his best to carry out the top secret order to help form the Werewolf. In the main, he saw two areas where his werewolves could be successfully employed. In that part of East Prussia, already captured by the Russians, where there were still large numbers of Germans who had not fled before the advancing Red Army, who could help to hide and feed the guerrillas. And in the Eifel region, in the west between Aachen and Prüm, where, in addition to German inhabitants who might help, the new German offensive was soon to be launched. It was to the Gauleiters of the districts bordering on these two areas that he sent his first messages, requesting them to find suitable men and women, and boys and girls, who would volunteer to take part in clandestine operations behind enemy lines in the near future. Soon the names of the volunteers began to flood into the Berlin office. By the end of the year, there were some 4,000 to 5,000 of them, eager fanatical young men and women, drawn mainly from the Nazi youth organisations, the Waffen-SS, and special sabotage units. The man responsible for recruiting, training and organising the Werewolf in the West was SS Police General Gutenberger, who had been a member of the party since 1925. Once the NSDAP came to power, he made a rapid career in the party, advancing to police chief of the Ruhr industrial city of Duisburg. 4 years later, as SS Police General, he took over command of the whole of the western area of Germany. It was Gutenberger's job to supervise the political activities of both the civilians and servicemen under his command. In the next weeks, Gutenberger went quickly ahead with the training of volunteers which the Gauleiters of Cologne, Dusseldorf and Essen sent him. These recruits were drawn mainly from the Hitler Youth or the Union of German Maidens. All of them had held some full-time position in the party youth organisations, and as a result, both the boys and girls could use most of the small arms, weapons used by the German army, be it revolver, machine gun or bazooka. What they did not know was how to use explosives and how to behave in enemy-occupied territory, though, because of the way they had been recruited, virtually all of them were intimately acquainted with the border area in which they would eventually operate. It was Gutenberger's job to ensure that these recruits received training in these two activities and be delegated the task of two men, SS Colonel Radatz, who was former Liebenstatter, and had been wounded at the Battle of Caen, just after the Allied invasion. The other, Lieutenant Colonel Niehaus, who was a regular officer with service in World War I. He had been employed in recruiting in Cologne until he had arguments with local SS recruiters. The two colonels picked Skolz-Hulkrath as the ideal location for their training activities. It was set in the middle of a small medieval village. Two main roads passed to north and south, connecting the village to the Ruhr, as well as the territories already occupied by the enemy. Yet no main road ran through the village itself, thus Hulkrath was well situated for speedy movement east or west, but was not open to prying eyes. Similarly, the castle itself, which dated back to the 14th century, was ideally suited for the training of an underground organisation, surrounded by a circle of medieval half-timbered houses inhabited by the villagers, which shielded it from the cobbled village street. It could only be entered by way of a narrow gateway, which was easily guarded. While the first batch of 50 volunteers, who included some miners from the Ruhr, as well as Hitler Youth, settled into their new quarters and were fitted out with SS uniforms, so that their cover story of being members of the guard company of the armed SS looked genuine to the locals, Niehaus set out to tour the front between Cleve and Skimmitt Fien. This was the area held by German Army Group B, commanded by Field Marshal Model, whose intelligent officers now assisted Niehaus in finding sites for the bunkers his people would use later. Colonel Niehaus' plan was that the werewolves should allow themselves to be overrun by the advancing Allied troops. they would take refuge in the underground bunkers, most of which were dug into the hillsides of the rugged Eifel Mountains, and were stocked with food and arms, from whence they would sally forth at night to attack the enemy in the rear. During the daytime, they could wander through Allied-held villages, dressed in civilian clothes and armed with forged papers provided by the Gestapo security man and spy catcher, Steuben Rourke, who was also attached to the staff. Every morning when Gutenberg woke, he could hear the Allied guns roaring in the Eifel. In the first week of December, Gutenberg received a shock. One of his aides brought a top-secret telex message from Himmler himself. Some Germans had become burgomasters in the areas where the Allies had captured prior to the second Ardennes offensive. One had been put in place in Aachen and had been allowed to select 20 anti-fascist Germans to run the small town as an experiment. Himmler had earlier given the order that every burgomaster should be shot. So what the Americans did when they took Aachen, which was the first part of German territory, was select someone they thought they could trust to be the mayor of that city, and they allowed him to select 20 people who were not Nazi supporters, or who said they wasn't, to help run the town. So obviously that's treachery in wartime, but that was the situation. Himmler asked in the telex message what has been done in the matter of the chief burgomaster of Aachen. In the footnote of the book Werewolf, the author writes, Gutenberg excused his lack of action by telling Himmler over the telephone that he had personal difficulties and so it was not possible to get through enemy lines. Presumably, Himmler did not believe his subordinate, but let Gutenberg get away with it a little longer. At 5:30 hours precisely, on the morning of 16th December 1944, 2,000 German guns crashed into action along the 85 miles of Ardennes front between Monschau in Germany in the north and Echternach in Luxembourg in the south. Up in the snowy fog-cloaked heights of the German Schienfeld, hundreds of tanks concealed in the fir forest began to rumble out of their hiding places to support the white-clad infantry. 1 minute later, a railway gun in the German town of Prum started lobbing huge 14-inch shells at the little Belgian road and rail centre of Saint-Vif, the first key town which had to be taken. The Ardennes offensive, Hitler's last gamble, in quotes, was underway. With some 250,000 men divided into three armies, two tank and one infantry, Hitler hoped to advance to the River Meuse and cross it south of Liège on the fourth day of the attack. From there, his tank columns would race for Antwerp, the Allies' chief supply port on the continent. Once this had been captured, Hitler would have cut off the major position of Allied supplies and at the same time divided the British and American armies. As a result, he hoped to put off the end of the war for a few more months and thus gain more favourable terms for Germany than those of the official Allied policy of unconditional surrender. In addition, he felt that if the war continued for a few more months, there would be a clash between the Western Allies and Russia, probably over the Balkans, where already the British and the Russians were in conflict, with a resultant breakdown of the alliance which could only be to Germany's advantage. Gutenberger, the author writes, while doubting in the efficacy of the counterattack, which was for the moment throwing back the Allied forces, welcomed it because it gave him an opportunity to postpone his unpleasant assignment. He secretly hoped that the murder of the chief burgomaster of Aachen would be forgotten altogether in the course of the offensive. The surprise German counteroffensive threw the remaining civilian inhabitants of Aachen into a panic. The German line was only a few miles away, and the Allied-held city and the civilians were used to gunfire, but the barrage of the morning of 16th December was different. When it was followed a little later by the explosion of the first V1s, whether these revenge weapons were intended for the Belgian city of Liège and had fallen short, or whether they had been aimed deliberately at the German city under American occupation, No one was ever able to find out. And they saw American trucks bringing in grim-faced infantry to help stem the counter-offensive. The few thousand Germans who remained in the city realised that their fellow countrymen were attacking in earnest. So what he's saying there is the first V-1 rockets fell on Aachen, I believe, which is German territory. I knew that the V-1s had been fired at Antwerp, but I didn't know that. I presume the author's right. He's not going to put the wrong information in the book. But there you are. For a while, Oppenhoff, that's the German man who volunteered to be Burgomaster of Aachen, thanked God in his prayers for the Americans that he had left his wife and children in Belgium, managed to calm the panic that broke out among his administration. God and the Heuwein will protect us, he told his alarmed colleagues, as the sound of gunfire daily grew louder. Note, the Heuwein is a high mountain ridge a little south of Aachen. One day the rumour spread through the town that the SS had already set up the gallows for them at the town of Uskeren, some 12 miles away. Thank God for the gallows, Dr. Miles broke the silence of the assembled administrators when they heard the rumour. I don't feel like being chief actor in one of Goebbels' show trials staged on the steps of the town hall, he said. But in reality, there was nothing to joke about. Even the Allied-controlled Aachener Nachrichten, the first newspaper authorised by the Allies in Germany, could not hold the seriousness in the Ardennes. And at night, anyone who cared to break the curfew and glance out of his blacked-out door could spot the angry red stabs of the German artillery everywhere in the surrounding hills. In the end, Franz Oppenhoff headed a delegation to Lieutenant Colonel Carmichael, dispensing with the aid of an interpreter for security reasons. Oppenhoff and his colleagues forcibly demanded that Carmichael protect them if the Americans were driven out of Aachen. The American colonel listened to their demands in silence. Then he told them to wait and disappeared into an inner room to telephone his superiors. Because of the German offensive, priorities for the military telephone net were very high, and it was 10 minutes before he returned and promised them that if the city had to be evacuated, they would be taken back by the American garrison. They heaved a collective sigh of relief. But Franz Oppenhoff had other problems than the threat posed by the American offensive. It was becoming increasingly clear to him that the Americans were very difficult people to deal with. For the smallest thing, he had to wait for hours in Carmichael's or Swoboda's office, invariably only to be told, "I'll see what I can do." A phrase he had come to know well, although he spoke hardly a word of English. Usually this meant nothing would be done. In Paris, General Eisenhower decreed that there would be no fraternization between the Germans and their conquerors. Allied soldiers would only address German civilians when their military duty demanding it, nothing more. When the order reached Major Swoboda, who up to this time had been friendly towards the chief burgomaster, he ordered Oppenhoff to come to his office at once. Swoboda received him coldly, without his usual exchange of greetings. Oppenhoff too noted that the American refused to take his outstretched hand. The major turned to Liesel Greven, who had spent several years in England and now acted as Oppenhoff's interpreter, and said, "It is very important that you translate my words exactly." Then, looking directly at Oppenhoff, he continued, "I have some unpleasant news for you. General Eisenhower has ordered a non-fraternization decree. From now onwards, all personal contact with Germans is forbidden. Every conversation with them is to be limited to the very minimum. Thank you. That is all." Oppenhoff stood looking at the American in disbelief. He had known the Major for 2 months now. They had celebrated Christmas together. Indeed, it was only due to his presence that he had been able to invite more than 3 of his colleagues for a drink at Christmas, since the Americans had strict regulations about the assembly of more than 3 German civilians. But Major Swoboda merely stared back at him in silence. Oppenhoff turned and went out. The Americans, shocked and angered by what they regarded as the European Pearl Harbor, displayed a sudden brutality in dealing with German civilians. When the infantry, fighting in the snows of the Ardennes, needed sheets to camouflage themselves, a requisition order went out to GIs, swarmed through the few houses still occupied by the local population. Not only seizing bedsheets and white tablecloths for camouflage, but throwing whole beds through the windows into the street below. After watching this senseless destruction of furniture and household goods, already in short supply, Oppenhoff went to Lieutenant Colonel Carmichael to protest. He did not find Carmichael, but another American officer told him, "You can be happy that our soldiers work our anger off on with furniture. You Germans do it with human beings." And if the Amis, that's Americans, weren't bad enough, his own fellow countrymen started to cause trouble. A wave of denunciation broke out under the stress caused by the offensive. The CIC began to arrest completely innocent Archeans who had been denounced by their neighbours as Nazis and spies. As the Ardennes offensive reached its crescendo, Oppenhoff grew steadily more despondent. Living in the most primitive conditions without his wife or children to cheer him up, he sat at night in his cradle-lit room, which was completely without heat, nursing a single glass of schnapps and brooding over his situation. Time and time again, he told his fellow councillors, that's the Germans who had elected to support the American experiment administration in Aachen, "It's no use," he told them, "no one wants to help us." And his colleagues, fellow traitors, I add, would watch him with serious faces. They knew that if Oppenhoff gave up, the whole city administration would collapse completely, and the Americans would never be able to resurrect it, in a city which divided into a score of warring factions, each out to gain the most advantage for itself. But in the morning, Franz Oppenhoff would have shaken himself out of his depression and be at his desk in his tiny dark office. I'm going to leave it there for now. I did, if you remember with my earlier podcasts, I used to like at the end, if there's been some kind of speeches recent or political activity, I like to put the audio at the end of these podcasts. So I'll continue with this next time I do a podcast. We'll probably do it in two parts, I should think. The next one will be longer. But I attended a meeting of the British movement in the East Midlands yesterday. The General Secretary, Steve Frost, gave a speech, and Steve should be on Voice of Albion next week, all being well. The British movement is not a political party. It is a kind of a campaign group, but I'll let Steve explain that next week. So I'm going to play it with his speech now. Thanks for listening. Take care. 14 words.
I'm aware that we're running short on time, so... I will keep it brief. Just a couple of points. That film, I mean, I know quite a lot about what...
Whoa!
What Islam gets up to. I know what these people's intentions are, but that film was just horrific. And as Neil says, there could have been far, far more of it. And that's the reason why we have to succeed. But there is one slogan that we use in our literature a lot, and I think that film sums it up. These people had not been allowed to settle here, these problems would not exist. Now, today I want to keep it short, but what I want to say is why we must succeed. Well, that film told you why we must succeed. A few weeks ago, Glenn and myself, we travelled up to Sunderland. We were invited up there by the Northern Patriotic Front, which is a local organisation up there. They asked me to come up and speak, which I did. Quite happy to go up there and speak to patriotic Brits, and there were a few of our northeast people in the audience anyway. But there was a bunch of guys from the infidels who've split off from the EDL, and all these guys are focused on is stopping a mosque being built in Sunderland. They don't see the rest of the picture. One guy in particular, he'd already had too much beer, And he seemed to be speaking for the bunch of blokes that was there. And he was very, very sure of himself. And he asked me how long I'd been involved in BM. How long had I been a National Socialist? How long had I been campaigning for the cause? And I told him. I said, I first joined in 1976. Been on the streets, been there, had it thrown at me. Rolled about on pavements, rolled about on pub floors. I've done all the violent stuff. Been there, been at the receiving end. I've campaigned, I've leafleted, I've sold papers on street corners. Won the T-shirt. And he totally misunderstood. He totally misunderstood the nature of our struggle. Because he's a typical one-minute wonder. And he said, you know, 1976, you're still not won. You're still not marching down Downing Street. You're never going to get anywhere. He didn't understand. We have to look long-term. People we've seen in the film, Militant Islam, they think long-term. They think in centuries. Not 5 years, not 10, centuries. There are no shortcuts. There are no easy fixes for our struggle. We have got nearly 60 years of immigration to fight against. We have to campaign against 50 and 60 years worth of propaganda, brainwashing the ordinary people out there. It's a struggle we must win. As Neil said earlier, there's no ifs, no buts. Linda said it. We've got to win. We have to set our minds to this. It needs dedication and it needs commitment. It's not something that can be picked up and worked on for a few weeks and then, oh, come back to it later. Because there are people like that out there. I've met them. They'll come out with you, they'll leaflet a couple of weekends, and then they'll say, we're not in power yet, so, I'll leave it for a bit. You can't come back to it later. This is serious. Linda again has said something. What we are doing as an organisation is we're putting down roots in communities. Not just here, it's happening in other places as well. We're digging ourselves in. Getting involved with things. Today, Steve's had a crew out. They've been on the streets of Barnsley. How much trouble did you have?
None at all. None.
How much National Socialist literature did you put out?
Over 1,000 leaflets, however many you gave me yesterday, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent.
There is a point. And the last time you went out, 2,000 leaflets at Leeds, wasn't it? And Castleford, and Ossett, and before. Baz and the lads have been out round here, Ilkeston, Heena, Eastwood, wasn't it?
Eastwood.
How much trouble did you get?
None at all.
People are there, they are prepared to listen. They are prepared to listen. What the problem is, getting them activated. We have to consider seriously the size of the task against us. It can be done. If we have the will to do it. Time is against us. Time is against us. But we have the will and the determination, then we can do it. I want to read you something now. From the 1930s. This is something that Adolf Hitler wrote. And it's as relevant now as back in the 1930s when he wrote it. What we must fight for is to safeguard the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children and the purity of our blood, the freedom and independence of the fatherland, obviously he's talking about Germany, so that our people may mature for the fulfilment of the mission allotted it by the creator of the universe. Long term. Decades later, the American racial revolutionary David Lane took those inspired words and without losing any of the meaning, he condensed it down. The ideas expressed by Adolf Hitler in just one sentence. David Lane took what was said there and turned it into just 14 words. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children.
Yeah, yeah.
14 words. The same thing condensed down. And it's the very foundation of modern National Socialism. And in its implementation, we can cover every aspect of political and social change that we need to make. Economic, social welfare, immigration, citizenship, the political structure of both national and local government, banking, credit, geopolitics, foreign policy, everything. Those 14 words apply to it all. And the steps that we as a movement are taking now, they are small steps. But they are important steps on that long, hard, difficult road. And at the end, our goal is the realisation of the 14 words. Exactly what Adolf Hitler wrote about in the 1930s, because he was talking long term, and we're talking long term. We're not saying 10 years we'll be in power. What we're saying is the evil prediction that the film we just watched said, by 2050 we will be a minority in our own country. No, we won't. And I've said this before, again and again. The British people, when they are pushed into a corner, come out fighting. And people are already expressing to our activists on the streets that they like what we have to say. Because with British movement, there is no compromise. There is no watering it down, no salt in the soup. It's National Socialism or nothing. Race or nothing. It's 14 words or nothing. And we will have our country back. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.